T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
This time, on To War and Back.
No news is good news to families back home. And that's what our families have to deal with. I mean, can you imagine that? You go for weeks and months on end and you don't hear anything and you just have to assume, well, he's still alive. Otherwise, I would have heard something.
Did I miss my parents and my sister? Sure. But I was also really good at blocking that out. Not that it was the healthy thing to do, you know, mentally and emotionally, but I blocked a lot of that out. And luckily I had 2 Marine parents that had kind of dealt with it in the past, and they knew the right things to write in the letters and send on their way.
They sent me through my first psychiatric appointment. I remember he just literally spun around in his chair, handed me the prescription. I said, "What is it, sir?" He says, "It'll help you sleep." From the first time I took that medication, I lost control of my life.
Welcome back. I'm Phil Briggs, a journalist and a Navy veteran. And this is the story of 3 American combat vets. U.S. Marine Corps Sergeant Kirstie Ennis, U.S. Marine Corps Major Scott Husing, and U.S. Army veteran Sergeant Boone Cutler. Where we left off was a helo crash, and Kirstie had just had her leg amputated. It wouldn't go well. She would eventually have further surgeries, making it an AK or an above-the-knee amputation. And for her, stuff's really going to go south soon. For Major Scott Husing and the Marines of Echo Company, they were still fighting a grueling fight in Ramadi, Iraq. But on this episode, I wanted to focus a bit more on the story of Boone Cutler.
My name is Gene Lumsden. I was running a company in Southern California, a chain of retail stores, and we were looking for a director of loss prevention. And Boone came in. And we talked, and he interviewed me, or I interviewed him, and probably he interviewed me too. I just didn't know it. And
he's sort of like that.
Yeah. And so, one thing led to another, and I felt that he was the right person for the job, and we needed someone to oversee the stores. And, you know, in retail, the one thing you have to always watch out for is theft.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It's not so much external theft, internal theft becomes a bigger problem. So we talked about that, and then we hired Boone, and he went to work, and he put together some programs, and he went into the stores, and he became friends with everybody in the store. That way, by being friends, and he'd pick out one person per store that he became even closer to, that if something happened, they'd feel comfortable in calling Boone and say, "You need to come in here. We think we got a problem." So, you know, time went on, and one day I was sitting there after 9/11, and of course, everyone is still kind of in shock, and Boone walks into my office, and he says, "Gene," he said, "I'm going back in." And I said, "You know, Boone, it doesn't surprise me." I said, "Because if I could ever pick someone out to go over there and fight for us, you'd be the first one I'd pick." And I said, "You got my support, and we're here for you."
That's awesome.
And that was it.
Boone would go on to deal with the physical injuries from Iraq that we've heard about. But there was a lot more that went into his deployment being in PSYOPs. See, PSYOPs isn't typically the first job that comes to mind when you think about war. But it's a job that even fellow combat vets admit is friggin' dangerous and one of the spookiest jobs in the military. So I wanted to talk to Boone more about what it was like. We met up for beers at the Red Dog Saloon in Virginia City, Nevada.
You know, we kicked a lot of doors in Sonder City. I mean, that's all night long. That's usually what we're doing. Find, you know, people to interview, you know, field interrogate, or excuse me, field interview.
What was your MOS when you were in Sonder City then?
Psychological operations.
So what is that?
That basically means convince people to do shit without having to kill them. or use killing them as an influence so you don't have to kill more of them. Now, there are different types of ways you do that. You know, sometimes you use the carrot, sometimes you use a stick. An average campaign would go like this. We know we're going to hit an area. So, say they need food. So we'll go out there and give away a bunch of frozen chickens, frozen turkeys. So now you start identifying who's willing to talk to you. How are they willing to talk to you? You try and find key communicators that are willing to speak your message to their group. Then you know how information flows, okay? So I know if I talk to one person, that information is gonna go from me to them to their group. So let's say we go in there and we go do a raid. Of course, we're gonna roll people up, we're gonna bring them into custody, so on and so forth. Well, invariably, at some point in time, we're gonna let these people out of jail. If the enemy is to think that while they were in jail, they were giving up information, well, then that person's probably gonna die. They're gonna be killed, they're gonna be murdered.
Right.
Well, that's a usable condition of the environment. Then I go back out there, and I'll say this was a person that was a popular person, okay? I'm gonna go out there and say, yeah, he was a great man. And then I go, someone might say something like, it's too bad the militia killed him. See, because my enemy is the militia. So if a good person gets murdered, I'm gonna pin it on the militia to break public support away from the militia.
Mm.
Now, equally, if a bad person gets killed, well, I'm gonna change my message to continue to, so I can change those attitudes and beliefs. I'm gonna spread rumors.
Wow, that's crazy.
So, besides all the head traumas, the knee and back problems, Boone was the kind of warfighter who had literally been face-to-face with terrorists. I mean, more than getting shot at, imagine the hyper-alertness you'd feel from being suspicious, or even flat-out paranoid, of every person you see. So with all those experiences combined, we heard already how Boone's war ultimately ended when he called a medevac for himself. But when he got home, he was sent directly to Walter Reed. And that's when this story gets crazy.
Before I went to Walter Reed, they sent me to Longstuhl. They medevaced me to Longstuhl, Germany.
Germany, yep.
And that's where they kind of do an assessment on where you're going to go and whatnot. And they did this little assessment on me and everything. And they're like, you know, you're being assessed for traumatic brain injury, you know, knee this, shoulder that, blah, 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 blah. I'm like, okay, you know, let's fire up the surgical team. Let's get this done, you know, type of thing. They're like, no, we're going to send you back to the States to get that done. I'm like, okay, where am I going back to the States? And like, well, we're going to send you to Walter Reed. And I honestly thought, like, you guys are kind of overreacting here, you know. But, you know, based upon the scans and everything else, they were following their protocol. And then I got to Walter Reed, and then it was just like, you know, they're telling me how jacked up I am. I'm like, that guy's got no legs. Don't tell me I'm screwed up.
I'm torn between asking about, when did you notice your own medical condition deteriorating, or when did you notice that they were doping you up with a ton of drugs? Which came first?
I had my first psychiatric appointment, and they were giving me, I'm pretty sure they were giving me painkillers at that point, and I was waiting for surgeries. And they sent me to my first psychiatric appointment, and the doctor says, let's talk about your trauma. And I pretty much had an attitude about it, you know. And I said, listen, I don't have PTSD. That's for other people. That's not me. I have a head injury. I have a neck injury. I have orthopedic injuries. I don't need your appointment. I need you guys to focus on the surgeries I need so I can get out of here. We don't need to have a conversation. It's pretty much my sentiment and my attitude, and that's what I told him. Well, this guy's a major. He's a field grade officer. And he didn't want to talk to me at all after I said that. And I remember he just literally spun around in his chair, wrote out a prescription, handed me this prescription, said, go downstairs, get this filled, come back next week, same time. I said, what is it, sir? And he says, it'll help you sleep.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh, no problem, because I wanted to go to sleep and I couldn't sleep. Well, it was Seroquel. It was an antipsychotic medication, and it was a fairly heavy dose. And so from the first time I took that medication, I lost control of my life, because from that point, it was like, whatever you want to give me, I'll take. I don't care. You know, I just kind of really lost my way. And it was all from that first dose. Like I say, Walter Reed was a chemical prison to a lot of people. And I can understand that in some ways if it is to take care of an immediate situation. But it really appeared to me like nobody had any intention of weaning guys off these drugs. It was a matter of there was more injuries than there was care available. And so they used a lot of drugs. And I was on a lot of those drugs. And every drug has a different side effect for which they give you more drugs for. And
so with Seroquel, you might have gotten the sleep, but then you had something else and then they'd layer on.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was like, ODing on it. I used to sleep with a towel next to the bed because I knew invariably while I was asleep, I was going to get sick. And later on, I realized, oh, I was overdosing. And in a, you know, I'm always very conservative about the number of times I've overdosed, but, you know, we're talking dozens.
Jesus.
You know, what all these different medications. And, you know, you used to do really weird things. Like there's this one time, I remembered it later, but you know, taking Ambien and all this other stuff, take an Ambien, go to sleep, wake up 2 hours later, go, oh, I must have not taken my Ambien, take another Ambien, go to sleep for 2 hours, wake up, take another Ambien. I went through the whole process. You know, you have to go through the process in the military every now and then of updating your records. I was so blown out of my mind. I literally wrote down the beneficiary to my health insurance program as my dog.
My God.
You know, part was my grandmother. The rest was my dog. So when you say, you know, when did I realize the extent of my injuries? I don't know, maybe a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, right.
You know, it's something that you have to accept over time. And I didn't expect to live. There came a point probably after the first year that I became pretty OCD about suicide. My home situation was pretty much defunct. You know, after you're gone for a while and you've lived that life where you're in a combat situation, you don't keep in touch with people. Well, if you don't keep in touch with people, they forget about you too. I was getting every message under the sun saying, you're not a person people want to hang out with anymore. This isn't going to work. You know, you're so jacked up that we have to give you all these drugs just to make you non-violent, just to make you palatable for society, you know, all these things. And I'm thinking to myself, there's no way I can hold a job. You know, I don't have any money. You know, I'm not going to, you know, reach out to a group of people and ask for something. And the only reason they're going to help me is because of pity. You know, it's not my game. And there was no community of warfighters at that time. You know, we're talking 2007. You know, the Walter Reed neglect scandal was going on.
The height of it, yeah.
And I was a part of that. Yeah, you know, the way Walter Reed dealt with the neglect scandal is they didn't bring on more doctors necessarily. They brought on more layers of control. You know, when I first got there, I had a platoon sergeant and an assistant platoon sergeant, and they were pretty much admin guys, like, hey, you know, make sure you get to this appointment. You know, if you needed to be escorted to an appointment because you were jacked up or something, they'd get like a little team of escorts. They'd assign you one and get you to your appointments and all that stuff. After the scandal, it went from having a platoon sergeant to an assistant platoon sergeant to having a platoon sergeant, a squad leader. I think I had a team leader too, on some level. And they set everybody up in like it was an infantry battalion. You know, they set everybody up in these companies and platoons, and you had more layers of, and that was, I think, for two reasons. One, so they could have more accountability and know if someone was going to go to the press and talk about something and that would be a problem. And on some level, if there was a problem, it could be rectified at a lower level. And they thought that if they instituted more military discipline in a hospital environment, everything would be better. I get all that, but I also understand that I was in an environment where I was no longer going to lead troops and I was injured. I needed to be treated like a patient, not like a soldier. Guys truly fell back into their military roles because they weren't getting care fast enough. And so MPs were pulling security. Guys were sharing medications. That's where I learned how to, you know, snort OxyContin to make it last longer. To get relief, you know, I would memorize which doctors would give me Dilaudid, you know, at night at the ER and which ones wouldn't. And so I'd come in, I'm like, hey, is Doc so-and-so on? Yeah, they're on. Okay, cool. And I'd sign in and I'd say, hey, Doc, you know, it's one of those nights. And God bless him for doing it, because he was the guy that was helping me get sleep when all the other stuff wouldn't work. And so literally about every 3-4 days, you know, about twice a week, I'd hit the ER and this was not unusual. Guys were doing anything they could do to survive in that environment. They were relying on each other. I can't tell you. I mean, there was this one kid, I remember he was getting off the bus one day and he'd been shot up really good. Some just said, you know, talk to this kid. And I said, hey, brother, what's going on, man? He goes, they won't fill my meds. And I mean, he's got dirty bandages. He's bleeding. You know what I mean? And I'm like, what are you talking about? And he's like, they told me to come back tomorrow. They won't fill my meds. And I need my meds. We live in a hospital and can't get damn medical care. Okay. And I'm like, well, what meds? And he's like, blah, blah, blah. He's like, come here. Take mine. One thing I'll tell you about the warfighter spirit, when we're in that environment, we took care of each other, but we shouldn't have had to.
Boone's family and friends drifted away for reasons I'm not exactly sure about. What I do know, though, after talking to these veterans, is that staying in touch isn't always easy for warfighters. They grow used to some distance. Scott and Kirstie told me a little more about how that felt.
There were times, obviously, when I called back home, maybe every month at best, to check in and just say, hey, everything's all right. And usually, no news is good news to families back home. That's kind of the moniker that we subscribe to, is, you know, no news is good news. If you don't hear anything, things are going fine. Just deal with it. And that's what our families have to deal with. I mean, Can you imagine that? You go for weeks and months on end and you don't hear anything and you just have to assume, well, he's still alive. Otherwise, I would have heard something. That's pretty sobering.
I think because I was so young, you know, I'm not married. I still don't have kids or anything like that. Like, I didn't have anything of, you know, my own to miss. Did I miss my parents and my sister, you know, the extended family? Sure. But I was also really good at blocking that out. I recognized the fact that missing anything or being homesick, that's not going to speed time up. You know, being upset about something taking place and wanting to call home and cry about it for a little bit, is it really going to make a difference? No. So I blocked. I mean, not that it was the healthy thing to do, you know, mentally and emotionally, but I blocked a lot of that out. And luckily I had two Marine parents that had kind of dealt with it in the past, and they knew the right things to write in the letters and send on their way.
Like Scott and Kirstie, Boone didn't have a lot of time to focus on life back home, but he did keep in touch with his old boss, Gene Lumsden.
Boone called me from Walter Reed. And when he would talk, I could hardly understand him, because of all the drugs and everything that he was on, he was slurring his words. And I thought to myself, what is going on there? And I said, Boone, I am getting you out of there. And so it was laid out to me what I needed to do. And I put Boone on my payroll immediately while he was in Walter Reed, moved he and his family to Reno, Nevada, paid for that. He had a job waiting for him when he got to Reno. And I made sure that everybody in the company understood what he was going through. And we were going to work with him and bring him along, because the one thing I realized in talking to Boone, he was not going to get better at Walter Reed. He needed to get back into civilian life where people are I'm not going to say normal, but somewhat normal.
Yeah, sure, sure.
Yeah,
sure.
And
I mean, you're not surrounded by sick people. You're not surrounded by injured people.
That's right. You're exactly right. And so we did, and he slowly came around, and we saw the changes, and he's getting better and better as time was going on. And what I did was I put him on credit collections, and he was fantastic at it.
Hmm.
He was so good because he knew how to talk to them and become their friend. And next thing you know, I mean, we got money coming in that people had owed us for a while. So it all worked out really well.
Now, when you hear Gene say all that, it might sound like it's no big deal. He's just doing the right thing. But the truth is, that's one of the biggest deals I've ever heard. See, you don't often hear, if ever, of a non-blood relative going out of their way to give somebody a job, get him a home, moving them across the country, and then going to Walter Reed and demanding they get discharged to their care. So when I talked to Boone, I mean, you could feel it. Just how big of a gesture from Gene this really was.
When you've been locked away in a hospital for a couple years, trust me, everybody you think cared about you, they're gone. They stop calling. They've got other things to do. Life goes on. You know, all these factors really kind of make it easy to take your own life. It seems like that's the thing you should do. It just does. It's like, okay, well, what's my logical recourse? Got no place to go. Not going to beg. I really don't care if I live or die. And it's one more death among others. And it's one I don't have to mourn. How hard can that be?
Hmm.
It's not hard. You know, it's not hard. And so that was my mindset, and I was convinced of it. And then all of a sudden, I'm talking to Gene, and my call was more or less just to kind of hear people's voice one more time. I was making the rounds. And Gene said, hey, I want you to move to Reno. I want you to come to work for me. And, you know, I had to tell him that I'm not the same guy. And he said, I don't care. Just get here. We'll work out everything out. You just get here. I would like to be able to sit here and say, I was so thankful because I was rescued at that moment. But there were still a lot of unknowns. But I also know as a warfighter that if you have the means to resist, you can't surrender. And Gene gave me one thing that gave me the means to resist. Therefore, as part of my ethos, I could not take my own life. And in some ways, I was pissed because at least I had a date it would be over. And now it wasn't going to be over. He didn't just give me an opportunity. He made me take on the concept of it's not over. And since then, I've had several situations where I thought maybe this might be over, but it gave me a sense of resiliency that I didn't even have before. Because you are never out of the fight.
Why wait? Binge all episodes now, exclusively on the Radio.com app, or get this week's episodes wherever you listen to podcasts. On behalf of the production team here at To War and Back, I wanted to thank you for listening to this episode. And before we get into the next one, I wanted to share just a couple really heartfelt things. Specifically, I want to share with you three organizations that are doing incredible things for veterans. There's the Kirstie Ennis Foundation, a nonprofit that she founded to support deserving organizations and help improve the quality of life of veterans. Whether it's funding to help a veteran business expand, or whether it's taking veterans outside to experience firsthand the healing powers of Mother Nature, supporting the Kirstie Ennis Foundation is supporting veterans. Major Scott Husing and the Save the Brave organization has a simple philosophy. There's no pill, no prescription, and no vaccination that can cure the effects of PTS better than connecting with fellow vets. That's why when you donate to SaveTheBrave.org, veterans go on fishing trips, they go on hiking trips, but more than anything, they stay together. Just hanging out, fishing for the afternoon. I mean, getting back together again is what makes the difference real. And it's also what's really going to make a difference in the epidemic of suicide. And that's where Army veteran Boone Cutler really wants you to make a difference. Now, if you look up livetotell.org, you'll find the incredible story
of Lance Corporal Johnny Lutz. Lance Corporal Lutz fought the good fight with his PTSD, but sadly took his own life. But now his name and his life serves to inspire every generation behind him. LiveToTell.org also has an annual calendar full of events and get-togethers. Whether it's concerts or backyard barbecues, they're always ensuring that the warfighters stay connected. Surviving combat is hard. Surviving with the memories of war can be even harder. But through the work of the Kirstie Ennis Foundation, SaveTheBrave.org, and LiveToTell.org, there's a few places out there doing the work to ensure that warfighters don't just survive, but that they thrive. Supporting any of them is the best way to say thank you for your service.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.